From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleinman, and this is Good Food. Today, your food stories told live on stage.
So let's take a minute to talk about Reese's Peanut Butter Cups, right?
I'll talk to the woman who invented crack pie, and yes, it is as addicting as it sounds. Mark Bittman of the New York Times is here, and how one home baker is taking on the health department. But first, let's check in with Laura Avery, who's at the Santa Monica Farmers Market, for a look at what's fresh and in season this beautiful week in Southern California.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We love the peak of summer when the heirloom tomatoes have finally come in, the apples have started pouring in, and of course, we're always looking for very unique ways to further enjoy these wonderful fruits of the summer. Robert Wemishner is here at the market. He's a very frequent shopper here. He's a well-published cookbook author. He's also a professor of professional baking at the LA Trade Tech College, and his most recent book is the second edition of his book entitled The Dessert Architect. So, Robert, you're here, and you're going to give us a fascinating twist on how to use two of our favorite summer items, apples and tomatoes.
Absolutely. Thank you, Laura. Yes, you know, I found some great apples at the market today, and of course, tomatoes are in profusion as well in all colors, shapes, sizes, and flavors. But for the apples, I like to take it into a savory direction. So I will take something like a Gravenstein or the pippins that I saw today and core them and then roast them fairly slowly in the oven, a little bit of olive oil, a touch of salt, and then fresh sage leaves. And serve that as an accompaniment to something like a roasted pork or chicken. On the tomato side, I love to do something that is similar to what you think of as an apple tartatin, but instead of using apples, use tomatoes. So we slice them rather thickly, lay them in a cast iron pan that has been coated with a mixture of butter and olive oil, and then roast them, touch of sugar, and cook the juices down so they're really starting to caramelize. At that point, pull them out of the oven and either top them with a pre-baked round of a very flaky, buttery puff pastry, or a thin sheet of it, and then put it back in the oven, allow the dough to bake. Serve that with something like a wonderful fresh vanilla ice cream, and you have a fantastic dessert.
And the baked apples, you sprinkle the sage leaves all over the top. How does that get evenly infused if you're just sprinkling it on all these hard apples?
You know, actually, what I do is I core the apples and I put the sage leaves inside and then also in the bottom of the pan where I have the olive oil so that it, you know, it perfumes, cover the whole thing as well, and that'll keep the aroma in.
All that wonderful buttery, sagey, juicy stuff left in the pan, you just spoon that all over everything?
Absolutely. Oh. Never leave that behind.
Well, we love to see you here, Robert, and it's always great to catch up with you because your books are great.
Thank you very much, Laura. Pleasure to be here.
That was Robert Wemishner. He is an author and he's a pastry chef in the professional baking department of the LA Trade Tech College. His latest book, which is a reissue, second edition, is called The Dessert Architect. This is the time of the year when the fresh dates come back to the market. A lot of people don't know that dates have a specific season and that they are fresh and harvested in August. And they come off the trees, you know, at one time of the year, and then the rest of the year you're buying your dates in various stages of freshness, and as the year progresses they dry and they become more like a traditional date that you might see in a grocery store. But right now, in late August, mid-August, is the time when the fresh dates are coming off the date palms out in the desert. Alvaro is here today. He's from Batista Ranch, and they have an organic date farm in Mecca. And today we are just so excited about eating these soft, fresh dates. And you've got three different kinds today, Alvaro, that are just now coming in. Some you even have that are on the stem with the hard dates and the softening dates on the same branch. So tell us the three varieties you have and tell us the difference in their flavors.
Right now we have the Kadrawi. It's the one that tastes like pure brown sugar. That one just leaks. I mean, it's so delicious and creamy, and it melts. It's like brown sugar and like a sweet yam. And also the honey, it tastes like a sweet yam exactly when it's nice and cooked. The halawis, you can eat it crunchy, and you can eat it also like juicy, or half and half. That's when it's the best, I think. The halawi also, well, this is our second or third year we started bringing them in crunchy. Like the barhis are, wow, one of the best of the best. But the halawis, we started bringing them, and people started to liking them, so we're bringing them more and more, like treat them half and half.
Right, and when you say half and half, these are the ones that are, you bring the whole spray of the dates that are on the little stem as they grow on the tree, and then the date is a bright yellow, and then it starts to slowly turn that beautiful brown, and it gets softer and softer, so when it's half yellow and half brown, and you eat that, you get the flavor of the really soft date, and then kind of the crunchy date, and kind of the more fruity flavor of the date, and it's like wonderful, and it's only at this time of year when you can get that perfect combination of the half and half.
Right now we're starting, so you still get another month from now to another month to get the halawis. The halawis go by so fast, so probably 2 weeks of halawis, and then the barhis, we should have them for another month or so.
Okay, and the barhis, the other one, that's the little round one that when it's fresh, it tastes like a coconut. It has that really nice coconut flavor to it, too.
Yeah, that's the one that tastes like a young coconut. The more you chew on it, the more juice you get out of it, the better it gets.
So if I buy a spray of these yellow dates and I just take them and put it on my counter, they'll just do that half and half. They'll start to ripen. You can pick one or two off a day and just enjoy those all the way through the ripening process.
Exactly, or just eat them like that. This is like a decoration you can eat. It's beautiful.
Alvaro, you come to the Wednesday Santa Monica, Saturday Santa Monica, Sunday Santa Monica, and Saturday Pico. So you're in all of our markets. Thanks so much, Alvaro.
Thank you, Laura.
That's Alvaro Batista. They have an organic date ranch out in Mecca. And now is the time for about the next 6 weeks, according to Alvaro, where we can get these soft dates that are super ripe and super delicious and literally will melt in your mouth. Enjoy them now. This year, the Santa Monica Farmers Market celebrates its 30th anniversary, and we're so proud to be partnering with a nonprofit organization from Chicago called FamilyFarmed.org, and we are going to be producing a farmer trade show in the month of September, starting on September 14th, going through Sunday, September 18th. We'll have multiple events, programming all around the city, Santa Monica High School, Santa Monica College, the Broad Stage, and of course, we'll have our big Farmer Chef Gala Friday night, September 16th, at the beautiful Annenberg Community Beach House. So go to goodfoodfestivals.com, or you can also go to the Santa Monica Farmers Market website, look up all the events, sign up, plan to attend. It's going to be a wonderful 4 days of farmer-forward programming. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Recipes for Robert Wemishner's tomato tart tatin and baked apples with sage are on the Good Food blog. Earlier this month, Good Food collaborated with The Moth for a special story slam. 10 brave storytellers took the stage to tell their favorite food stories, without notes, in front of a standing room only crowd. We heard about one woman's summer job making hot dogs in Yellowstone, and another young man's desire to eat pickled herring despite a life of vegetarianism. The following story, told by Bill Ratner, had me smiling ear to ear.
So when my daughter was a little girl, we used to travel a lot as a family. And when you travel with a kid, there are issues about food. And every time you sit down, there are conversations like, "What's this, Daddy? It tastes horrible." And the truth is, my daughter and I, from a very early age, had a distrustful relationship around food. When she was 6 months old, we took her to Zumaya on Melrose, which featured kind of fancy Mexican food. And we had a little sassy seat, and we, you know, screwed it to the table, and she was all excited playing with the chips, and I had a margarita and chips and salsa. And then, because it was fancy Mexican food, they didn't plop spoonfuls of frijoles next to the rice. They put little, very elegant Mexican pinto beans in a bowl with, like, a marinade. So this is perfect for my daughter. So I took a spoonful, and I tasted it, and tasted fine, and I held it out to her, and very trusting, she opened her mouth and started chewing, and then, and they were spicy, and my wife said, "They're spicy. Why did you give them to her?" And I said, "Well, my tongue was desensitized by the margarita and the salsa." So this set up our relationship of fear around food. So when she was six, we go to China, and we stay in this old hotel called the Peace Hotel in Shanghai. That was regarded as the most prestigious hotel in Shanghai before 1949, when the Chinese communists took it over and put in a lot of bureaucrats and file cabinets and kind of dumbed it down as a hotel. But by the time we got there in 1993, the Chinese were already preparing to purchased the rest of the world. And so it had gotten a new paint job, and we checked in, and we were very hungry, and we got in the elevator and got off at the floor where the concierge had said there were 8 restaurants. And we walked, and we walked through these old Art Deco wood-paneled hallways with Chinese vases and exotic folding screens, and it was abandoned and progressively darker. It's like Diary of an Opium Addict with Vincent Price just before he falls through the floor of the opium den. And then finally we're in this little ballroom, and a waiter comes up with menus and seats us, and there are a few other couples in there. And they feature Shanghai cuisine, lion's head meatballs, and Shanghai hairy crab. And the menu has English descriptions. And for the crab, it says, Shanghai people proud small portions for tasty foreign pupils. So my wife orders hot pot, which is probably going to be safe. And about 10 minutes later, the waiter rolls up this big stainless steel cart with a huge crockery cook pot on it and opens it up and starts to serve us all kinds of glutinous substances and seafood. And my daughter stares at her plate. She's 6 years old, and her eyes begin to widen. There is a large black object on her plate. And I'm thinking maybe it's a chunk of whale tongue or, like, you know, squid neck or something. And she looks up at me and says, "What's this, Daddy?" And the Chinese waiter, who I hope says, "That's a Chinese fish stick," says, "That's sea eel." And she stares at it and stares at it. And it's ribbed like an earthworm and large and dark. And she takes her fork and she pokes it. And when she apparently decides it is not going to leap up and attack her, she spears it and, looking at me and her mother, puts it in her mouth and chews it and says, good. That was the moment at which my daughter became what she lovingly likes to call a real foodie.
That was Bill Ratner performing at the Moth's Good Food Story Slam. Later on today's show, we'll hear the night's winning story.
This is Good Food producer Jillian Ferguson. Join me and Evan Kleiman this Thursday on the rooftop of the Standard downtown for our monthly Good Food Happy Hour. Sip cocktails by the pool and meet other Good Food listeners. That's this Thursday, August 25th at the Standard Hotel in downtown LA. Find us on the rooftop between 7 and 9 p.m. and be sure to get there early.
Tax the bad and subsidize the good. It's easier said than done, right? But Mark Bittman, noted minimalist and food policy op-ed writer for the New York Times, believes it can happen. He's here today to decode current food subsidies and propose some interesting alternatives.
The primary foods or near foods that are subsidized are corn and soybeans. Those get direct subsidies as well as indirect subsidies from both the government and from us as taxpayers. And what's not subsidized is kind of real food, like fruits and vegetables maybe get a couple $100 million a year in some kinds of subsidies or others. And corn and soybean alone get around $5 billion a year in subsidies.
Okay, let's go back to just talking about this idea of taxing something that's not, quote, good for us. Is there any precedent for taxing consumables that are bad for us?
Well, tobacco is the most obvious, and it did take a long time from the first Surgeon General's report to a time when there was a real victory over the tobacco companies, but it did happen. And so there is a precedent for government action in saying, we don't want you marketing things that are going to hurt our citizens. And we're not going to make these things illegal, and no one's talking about making soda or junk food illegal, but we're going to make them more expensive so as to discourage their consumption. And in the case of tobacco, that's worked. In the world of food, what would be really great is to discourage first the consumption of soda by an excise tax of real proportions on sugar-sweetened beverages, not just soda, but Gatorade and Snapple and all the rest. And that would do three things, and they're all good. One, it would decrease the consumption of those things, which is in and of itself good because there's nothing good about consuming them. Two, would save us money in public health costs because the feds absorb about 60% of all health care costs, so we're all paying for each other's health care. And three, it would raise some money that could be used for other good things, and among those other good things, I would suggest that we should subsidize the raising and selling and distributing and even cooking of real unprocessed plants, fruits, and vegetables.
Do you have any idea how much money in healthcare costs we're looking at saving if some of us ate more sanely, as you put it?
It's a projection. But it's in the tens of billions of dollars annually, almost as soon, within, say, 5 years of when you started doing this, and hundreds of billions of dollars annually eventually. I mean, it depends how big the tax is, and it depends what we do with the money that comes in.
So what are the objections to doing something like this, which just seems so commonsensical?
Well, there's the objection of industry, which will say anything that it has to say to justify its ability to continue to make profit on the health of Americans and our environment. And then there are objections of people who start talking about keep your hands off of what I eat, or this is nanny statism, and so on down the line.
And you're not telling people they can't eat a certain food. You're just saying if you're going to eat this food, then you're going to help pay for the consequences of eating this food.
One of the things we haven't talked about here is that big food, fast food companies, soda companies, junk food companies, so on down the line, spend tens, hundreds of billions of dollars a year marketing their products worldwide and in the United States. The amount of money that the federal government is able to spend to counter that marketing is in the, let me think for a second. Well, let's say it's 1/1,000th of that amount. It could be as much as 1/300th of that amount. Let's say it's 1/300th of that amount. So for every person who's saying, eat your vegetables, look at the government's nice little new pie chart, the plate, eat your five fruits and vegetables every day. And so for every time you see that, you're getting a message like, have it your way, 300 times more.
But there have been soda taxes initiated in various communities across the country and definitely out of the country.
There are 20 states or municipalities that are discussing soda taxes now. There are some that have them, but they're so small that you wouldn't notice them. But Denmark, Taiwan, Romania, Hungary are all enacting or have enacted some kind of fat tax or anti-junk food tax. And a couple of people in France are talking about it. I would like to see us take the lead on this as we did on tobacco. I mean, the United States was really a world leader in ending tobacco or in trying to end tobacco smoking. And other countries have followed our lead, and many have, in fact, surpassed us in the strength of their anti-tobacco laws. I would like to see us take the lead in this also, since exporting this deadly diet has been entirely our doing. It would be nice if we began to export a method of countering it.
What do you say to people who say that a tax on soda will fall hardest on the poor?
I say this. I say the poor whose health is generally worse than that of people with money will benefit by not drinking as much soda because their health will improve. And I say the poor will benefit because the subsidies that I'm proposing giving to fruits and vegetables and other good food will help poor people proportionally more than it'll help people with more money. I mean, it is, we are talking about, I should say that I don't expect anything like this to happen very soon, but you never know. But we are talking about here is a law, and you do laws for common good. It doesn't mean every single person in the country is going to like it. It doesn't mean every person in the country is going to benefit from it, but it is going to benefit. A program like this would benefit most people, and it would benefit poor people especially.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Always great to be here. Take care.
That was journalist and noted cookbook author Mark Bittman. Mark's the former author of the Minimalist column and now contributes food policy articles to the New York Times and New York Times Magazine. A link to his original article on food taxes and subsidies can be found at kcrw.com/goodfood. Next up, crack pie. It's as good as it sounds. Stay tuned. You're listening to KCRW and kcrw.com. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Is it possible to be addicted to a dessert? Well, if you're talking about Christina Tozzi's crack pie, the answer might be yes. As the pastry chef for the entire Momofuku restaurant empire in New York, Christina's made a name for herself, creating unusual desserts like cereal milk ice cream and compost cookies. She's here today to talk about her crack pie. This thing, this crack pie, has become huge. If you go on the internet and you put crack pie into the Google search engine, you come up with this huge conversation about it. Could you describe what it is?
We describe our crack pie very simply. We say it has a toasted oat crust and a gooey butter filling. And the gooey butter filling part is kind of the thing that throws people off and that also sells the pie because it's kind of... It is. It's what it is. It's a gooey butter filling. But what does that even mean? It's more how it speaks to people than what it actually means.
And the crack element is because?
It is wildly addictive. It kind of named itself, honestly. I was working as a pastry cook at WD-50, and I was just making some family meal dessert. A dessert for the staff to enjoy after staff meal, right before you kind of go into like the depths and the battle of dinner service. And I would just kind of make something, a different baked good every day for the staff to eat. And it was a Sunday and I was kind of running out of, mise en place, out of ingredients to throw something together for family meal. So I kind of just whisked together some like miscellaneous dairy products and sugar that I had, some regular sugar, brown sugar, heavy cream, some butter, some vanilla, some salt, and just poured it into a pie crust and threw it in the oven and walked away. And it didn't really bake off properly. It was kind of a little jiggly and really gooey. And that speaks to me, but I kind of knew that it might have been a total disaster. So I kind of put it to the side and didn't think about it. And when family meal was up, I served it to the staff and just kind of people's eyes started like popping out of their heads. We couldn't keep our hands off of it. We demolished that pie in minutes and we were kind of like arguing over slices and then saying, no, I don't want any more. And then somebody would be like, no, give me some more. And it honestly, it named itself.
How did it evolve to have that oat crust?
The oat crust, I can't even remember the crust that I had originally used to make the very first crack pie. But when we were going to open Milk Bar, I knew that it had to go on the menu. And I knew that to have something as like gooey and buttery and dense and sinful as a filling, I needed something to really kind of offset the sweetness and the gooiness and the richness from it. So I decided to make this kind of salty oatmeal cookie and to toast it down and then grind it into a pie crust to balance on some level the gooey richness and buttery goodness that is the filling.
Do you have a long-lasting relationship with regular pie? Did you grow up making it or appreciating it as an eater?
Pie always really amazed me growing up. Just there's something about pie crust and the work that people you can do with just, you know, your thumb and the side of your index finger, just the crimping and the lattice and what have you was always kind of just left me speechless and in awe, even when I made pie myself. But my favorite was always apple pie. It was always a really big thing in my family, but even more so than apple pie, apple dumplings, because it's kind of like your own little apple pie, but without having to fuss over making a slice.
Thank you so much, Christina.
Thank you, Evan.
That was Christina Tozzi. She's the executive pastry chef at all of the Momofuku restaurants, and she's the co-owner of Momofuku Milk Bar. We have Christina's crack pie recipe on the Good Food blog. Okay, so I'm talking about pie here for a reason. The third annual Good Food Pie Contest is just 4 weeks away. As always, we have an A-list lineup of judges this year. Jonathan Gold, Roxana Julepot, Russ Parsons, Zoe Nathan, and you? That's right. We're giving you a chance to sit at the judges' table at the Good Food Pie Contest on September 18th at LACMA. The catch? We're asking you to tell us the story of the pie that changed your life in 500 words or less. Submit your essay on my Facebook page, or you can email it to me at goodfood@kcrw.com. Full details about the essay contest are on the Good Food blog. I can't wait to read your stories. It's hard for me to talk about pie without at least mentioning ice cream. The two together are like peas and carrots, but better. Alina Shatkin of the LA Weekly recently embarked on a 30-day ice cream crawl across Los Angeles. She's here today to give us the scoop on her top 5 picks for best ice cream and best gelato. But first, I asked her to differentiate the two.
Well, sometimes it's a fine line, but generally gelato is, it's denser, it's creamier, it's a bit more velvety. It doesn't quite have the friction on the tongue that I think ice cream does. And supposedly, I don't know if this is true, but I like to believe it, gelato apparently has less calories.
Let's start with ice cream. Let's start at the bottom and then move to number one.
Well, one of my favorite places is called Saffron Spot. It's out in Artesia in Little India, and it has all sorts of amazing, gorgeous ice creams. They come in these very vibrant, candy-ish hues. Some of them have very wonderful, exotic names that sound to me like Star Wars planets, like Rajbog and Chiku. And I apologize to all the Indian speakers because I have no doubt I'm mangling those words. But they have great flavors, like the Rajbog is the sunflower yellow ice cream. It's flavored with rose and cardamom and has all sorts of bits of cashews studded throughout. Really good.
So what would number four be?
Well, number four is a place called Jerry's Soda Shop, and it's located inside the DeSoto Pharmacy in Canoga Park. So it's a little bit of a haul if you don't live all the way out there, but they make the most amazing ice cream float I have ever had, hands down. Now, it starts with a frosty, cool pint mug that they dip in chocolate, and they let the chocolate harden. Then they put ice cream in. They put in a big scoop of Lapperts ice cream, soda water, chocolate syrup. There's whipped cream on top, cherries, nuts. And once they've dipped the mug in chocolate and it's hardened, there's actually chocolate on the outside, and you can chip away at the chocolate that's on the mug as you eat the ice cream soda.
Children must go nuts there.
I would think so, yeah.
And then what's number three for the ice cream category?
So number three is Mateo's Ice Cream and Fruit Bars down in Culver City. They do a lot of these great Mexican ice creams like leche quemada, which is one of my favorites. It means burnt milk. And to me, when it's done well, it really tastes like the topping off creme brulee. Like if you just had the topping, it's amazing. They do all sorts of other things. They do mame, which is another fruit that's not commonly found here, but it's got this great flavor that's sort of, I think, is sort of between peach and pumpkin. But again, it's really hard to describe unless you've had it. And one of my favorites that they actually do, well, I love their coconut and their walnut, but I also really love their coffee ice cream. Because I feel like a lot of coffee ice creams just taste, they're too sweet, they're too cloying. This one has a really nice, strong, slightly bitter taste and just a coffee flavor throughout.
Okay, number two.
Well, number two is Sweet Rose Creamery. How can you go wrong there? And you go there, there's always a line out the door, and when you try the ice cream, you know why. Their fresh fruit flavors are amazing. In the summer, their sweet corn is just to die for. And I think they probably make my favorite banana split and my favorite sundae in this town. They do one sundae that actually comes with two slices of bacon on top. But really, I'm a sucker for their banana split because everything they do is with such care and attention to detail. The bananas are great. The ice cream is made from, you know, the best ingredients. The whipped cream is heavy, not just the, you know, typical stuff from a can. And even the toasted almonds they sprinkle on top are thin sliced and lightly toasted with, I think they're lightly sugared too. It's just perfect top to bottom.
So delicious. And now we come to number one.
Now we come to number one, and people who have been to farmers markets around Los Angeles will probably recognize this, but not that long ago, the owner, Jessica Mortarotti, opened her Carmela's ice cream shop in Pasadena right on the border of Altadena. Their ice cream is just superb. The way she balances the flavors is amazing, and she comes up with some really innovative combos, too. Like, she'll do things like spiced strawberry, where she'll take a regular strawberry ice cream and just tart it up just a little bit with a hint of pepper or some other spice. It's wonderful.
Okay, so now let's move from ice cream to gelato.
Well, the first place I'll tell you about there is Gelato Bar. It has two locations, one in Los Feliz and one in Studio City, and it's owned by Gail Silverton, who is a sister of Nancy Silverton, who you may know from Mozza's Fantastic Pizzas. She just does some really fantastic flavors there. One of my favorites at Gelato Bar is pear, which is a flavor you don't see very often, and she just does it in this way that it just seems to extract every drop of pear essence.
Mm, yum. Next.
Then we have Pazzo Gelato, which is located out in Silver Lake, and more recently just opened a second, slightly smaller location in Echo Park. I love what they do with chocolate and with really innovative flavor combos. I love their dark chocolate. They use really dark Valrhona chocolate. Sometimes they'll do a little bit of cayenne, so you get a spicy variation. Sometimes they'll add almonds or other toasted nuts, so you get something kind of chunky. Other times, just the straight chocolate is wonderful.
And then for number three, we're going all the way out to Malibu.
We are going all the way out to the Malibu Country Mart for Grom Gelateria, which is apparently an Italian and a New York chain that just opened its first location here in Los Angeles. The sourcing of their ingredients is spectacular. In fact, you can read little booklets in the store about where everything comes from. They have one of my favorite chocolate gelatos in town. It is just so dark, so rich. The velvety texture of their ice cream is amazing.
And then we come to number two in the gelato category.
Number two is Delicieuse. It is a small gelato shop out in Redondo Beach. They may be best known for their goat's milk ice cream, although that's not the thing that I personally come there for. The thing that I really love there are their fruit flavors, which I think they just do exceptionally well. They have a wonderful one called Berry Michelle, which is a mix of strawberries, raspberries, blueberries, and blackberries. It is just one of the most intense berry sorbets I have ever had.
And now we get to number one in the gelato category, and I don't think anybody's going to fight you on this.
I hope not. There is a reason that Bulgarini perennially tops best gelato lists in this city. It deserves it. A lot of ice cream places, they go, and it seems like with their gelato or their ice cream, they've extracted the flavor of that particular fruit or element. But the stuff at Bulgarini actually tastes like it is that thing. It is the pistachio. It literally tastes like somebody has taken an entire grove of pistachio trees and crushed them down, compressed them into one, you know, baseball-sized scoop.
Oh, so wonderful. And we should say that Bulgarini is in Altadena.
It is in Altadena, kind of far away, and hidden in the back of a strip mall, kind of behind a supermarket. You really have to look and know where you're going to find it.
Well, I thank you very much for taking on the task of 30 ice cream shops in 30 days.
You're welcome.
That was Alina Shatkin of the LA Weekly. You can find all of Alina's ice cream suggestions, as well as a link to her original 30-day ice cream adventure at kcrw.com/goodfood. Speaking of summer treats, I'm excited to announce the latest selection for our cookbook club. It's Paletas, authentic recipes for Mexican ice pops, shaved ice, and aguas frescas by Fanny Gerson. The book is full of colorful treats like roasted banana ice pops and strawberry horchata shaved ice that will definitely cool you down this summer. Join KCRW as an angel and you'll receive 5 cookbooks throughout the year. Details are at kcrw.com/join.
And if you join KCRW before September 13th, you'll be invited to a very special dinner party that I'm hosting with Jimmy Shaw at Loteria Grill. We're hosting a Mex-Italian feast on October 10th. Details on the dinner and how you can be invited are at kcrw.com/goodfood. Coming up, I've got Jonathan Gold here in the studio. That's in 1 minute here on 89.9 KCRW and kcrw.com. I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Time now for a visit from Jonathan Gold. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Weekly, and he joins me here every week with a restaurant recommendation. Jonathan, where are we going today?
Koreatown. And I must say, some people accuse me of talking too much about pork in Koreatown, but I say you can never talk too much about pork in Koreatown.
Is pork a fairly new embrace in Koreatown?
I think so. I mean, it's a not a part of Korean cuisine, but it's not something that you consider a traditional part of it. But this is a different kind of pork place because it's a Japanese pork place that just happens to be also Korean.
And what is their take on pork?
It's a tonkatsu restaurant.
What does that mean?
Tonkatsu is the Japanese fried pork cutlet that's you can find at pretty much every izakaya in Japan, or any izakaya in Los Angeles for that matter.
And what's the name of the restaurant?
The name of the restaurant is Wako. Wako also happens to be the name of the big chain of tonkatsu restaurants in Japan, but I am assured that these have absolutely nothing to do with the Japanese ones.
And about where in Koreatown is it located?
There's a couple of locations. There's one that's under the truncated hat that used to be the Brown Derby, tucked away in a mini mall. And the one that I like to go to the best is probably the one on Olympic near Normandy.
Okay, so what should we order when we go?
There are basically a couple of flavors at Wako. First is the pork cutlet, of course, which is pork that's been probably dipped in egg and then dipped in and then rolled in panko or whatever the Korean equivalent of panko is and fried. And it's very light and it's as greaseless as something that's fried like that can be. And it's not overcooked, so the nice juicy flavor of the pork comes through and it's very crisp and it's delicious. The second is, I suppose, exactly the same process but with chicken breast, which somehow is even moister. It's a huge portion that covers maybe two-thirds of the plate. The moment of the meal at Wako that I think everybody loves the best is right after you order, but before you have any food on the table, they bring out a little clay bowl, like one of those taro graters that you may have seen. So it's ridged on the inside. And inside are like a small handful of toasted sesame seeds. And they hand you a pestle. And you grind the sesame seeds. And just the aroma of those freshly toasted sesame seeds coming up, just it permeates the air, goes into your nostrils. It's just wonderful. It reminds me almost of molecular cuisine, right, where you get a vapor as a first course.
People also really love interacting with their food.
I think so, too. So some people will want to pulverize to a fine powder, and some people will want the crunch still in it. And after you've pulverized it to your liking, somebody will come over and pour a little of the house, tonkatsu sauce in it, which is sort of a fruity, slightly spicy sauce that's traditionally used to dip the meat into.
So I see sitting in front of you an actual pictorial menu. It has a lot of pictures on it, and there seems to be many different dishes. So what are they besides the Milanese-style meat cutlets?
Well, there are the aforesaid combos with Milanese-style meat cutlets, which is to say you can get the pork or chicken, or they do fish that way, or they'll do New York steak the same way. And if you get it as a combination, you'll get a little bowl of noodles and a fried shrimp. It's not the best fried shrimp you've ever had, but it's a fried shrimp. They do a version of the katsu curry rice that's, you know, Japanese lunchtime standard with, you know, that sort of gloppy,
weird curry.
Exactly. And they have something called the cheese cutlet, which I've never seen anybody order. But it sounds alarming to me. And a variation called Orosi, which I actually did try once and I'm not sure I would recommend, which is the tonkatsu topped with like a solid inch and a half of grated daikon, then sprinkled with scallions.
I've been talking to Jonathan Gold of the LA Weekly about Wako Tonkatsu on Olympic between Normandy and Vermont and Koreatown. Get the exact address sent to your cell phone in a text message. All you have to do is text the words good food to the number 69866. That's good food to the number 69866. And, of course, you can see all of Jonathan's restaurant suggestions on our Good Food restaurant map, which is on the Good Food blog. Countless home cooks dream about creating a food business, and often the first step is to make a simple product at home and sell it. The last thing these ambitious hobbyists imagine befalling them is what happened to Mark Stambler, bread baker. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
Earlier this year, the LA Times published an article about your homemade artisan bread
right.
that you're making at home.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe for us the sequence of events that followed the article's publication?
What happened, to the best of my recollection, is that the day after it appeared, health department inspectors showed up at the two shops that carried my bread, and that was in the article. The health department showed up at both the shops that were carrying my bread and not only insisted that they could no longer carry it, but made them throw out a lot of their inventory because they claimed that it just wasn't being stored properly. And it, according to both the shop owners, it was the most difficult day that they had ever had in business.
And you're talking about the inventory that the health department made them throw away. It was not just your bread inventory.
No. It was like the soft cheese and things that they felt weren't being stored properly, not just my bread. In fact, my bread had been sold out long ago at both these stores, so there really was none of my bread on the premises when the health department inspector showed up.
Did they also show up at your house?
Yes, they did. Ironically, I wasn't there because I went to a meeting at the health department to try to resolve these issues. But while I was meeting at the health department at 8 o'clock in the morning, someone from the health department showed up at my house. They were just following up on the initial complaint to make sure that no bread baking was taking place on the premises.
Now, what was the health department's objection?
Quite simply, it's illegal. It's illegal anywhere in California to sell a food product, any food product that you have made at home, you cannot sell in California. Your home is not a commercial food processing facility, either wholesale or retail. In California, the law says it has to be prepared in a commercial food processing facility, even if the food is not potentially hazardous.
Because when one thinks about possible difficulties with foods, I would imagine that none of us even have an inkling that bread could fall in this category.
Whenever you see lists of not potentially hazardous food, and I have looked at many of these lists, bread is at the top of that list because there really is nothing in it that could pose any kind of a health threat to anybody who consumes it. So there are 25 states in the United States that have cottage food laws on the books. These are laws that allow people who are preparing not potentially hazardous foods to do so at home and sell it.
So who determines what is hazardous and what isn't hazardous?
Health departments. And there are lists and strict definitions that are put out, I believe, by the FDA. When you look at the list that all the other states are using, they are essentially the same lists. And it's bread, it's some additional baked goods and like granolas, coffees, teas, candy. Essentially what they say is if it's something that is time temperature sensitive, that means if it, you leave it out on a counter somewhere for a certain length of time, it'll go bad. And you know, a lot of foods that if you leave them out for any length of time, they don't go bad. With bread, it doesn't go bad. It goes stale, but it doesn't go bad.
So are cottage laws regulated?
Yes, they are regulated, but it varies from state to state. Now, I believe that in every state, you have to get some sort of license or permit to do this. And they realize that they just don't have the resources to go around inspecting everybody's home kitchen to make sure that it lives up to the codes and regulations that they're supposed to follow. So what they do is they reserve the right to come in and inspect if they have any complaint whatsoever about what comes out of your kitchen. And that seems reasonable. Speaking now as one of the co-founders of the Los Angeles Bread Bakers, we don't want to see ourselves set up in an opposition to local health departments because they perform a very, very valuable function. And so we here in California are working closely with the authorities just to make sure that any cottage food bill that's passed in California meets their requirements for, you know, public health and safety.
Is the cottage law for California being worked on right now?
Yes, it is. It's all happening really fast. When I first started baking bread, it never occurred to me that I would become a political activist. And somehow, in addition to baking bread now, I'm also doing some political things.
So are you involved yourself in putting together this cottage law for California?
The process is really being guided by a group up in the Bay Area called the Sustainable Economies Law Center.
Did you talk to them about the sort of slippery slope of if you're a hobby cook and you love baking and you bake every weekend and then you bring your stuff into your office and you give it away?
Bake sales are illegal in California. In fact, a friend of mine, when she heard about this, said, yeah, that happened at my synagogue out in the West Valley. Well, this was actually in Thousand Oaks, so it was in Ventura County, but it's statewide. So they advertised that they were going to have a bake sale as part of a rummage sale or something. The health department saw this online in their email list and said, you can't do it. Can't do it. You can't sell any baked goods. So that's the level at which the local health departments really take this. And it's frankly absurd. I never expected to do this, but I have actually started looking into Title 11, which is the wholesale food regulations for the County of Los Angeles, and the CFRC, which is the CRFC, the California Retail Food Code, which recently replaced CURFL and really changed things here in the state in terms of retail food. And in fact, to the extent that people on the retail side of Los Angeles County and the food inspection there didn't even realize that some of the things that they were telling the public were completely illegal and outmoded as far as the wholesale people in the County of Los Angeles were concerned.
Give me an example.
When I found out that I could no longer cook at home, when I could no longer bake at home, I started looking for a legitimate way to bake my bread. So I found that I could either do it in a wholesale food processing facility that I had to own, because it is illegal in Los Angeles County to share kitchens.
Now, is this just Los Angeles County or is this statewide?
Very good question. Friday, I had a phone conversation with Angelo Bellomo and Tom Paris, the two of the guys who run environmental health in Los Angeles County, and they didn't know.
Because there's all kinds of community kitchens all over the place.
And they are all in Los Angeles County, except in Pasadena, they're illegal. You can use a community kitchen, but you cannot sell anything that you have made in a community kitchen in Los Angeles County. They can't stop you from doing it for your own enjoyment. But no, in Los Angeles County, you cannot share a commercial kitchen. The person who makes something and sells it has to own that facility.
Thank you so much, Mark.
My pleasure.
That was Mark Stambler. Mark's an artisanal bread baker who's leading the Southern California initiative to introduce cottage laws in the state of California. We'll have a link to the LA Times article that sent the health department to Mark's door, as well as a link to the Sustainable Economies Law Center on our website. That's kcrw.com/goodfood. Next up, the winning story from the Moth's Good Food Story Slam. That's after this short break. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be right back. Food from KCRW and KCRW.com. There were so many wonderful stories at the Moth's Good Food Story Slam, but one story rose above the rest to win the competition. The winner of the night was Margot Lightman.
So let's take a minute to talk about Reese's Peanut Butter Cups, right? They are amazing, okay? But it's not just Reese's Peanut Butter Cups that are completely unbelievable to me. It's the holiday edition. It's the pumpkin. It's the tree. It's the heart. And it's the egg. And I'll tell you why, because it's a higher ratio of peanut butter to chocolate that makes it far superior to any cup. There are no ridges. It is all middle. I live for them. Right now we're in a period of darkness. Between egg and pumpkin, there's nothing. You start right around September, things start looking up. The pumpkin's coming, I know everything's gonna be fine. The day after Halloween is amazing. Why? Because they go on a half price. You have the option of half price pumpkins or full price trees. It's amazing. Then after the trees, half price trees, full price hearts. After the hearts, half price hearts, full price eggs. Then darkness. So this past winter, I was living in New York. We were in the period of half-price hearts, right before full-price eggs, which is when I start to get a little anxious, because I don't do too well in the period of darkness. I'm what many may call an emotional eater. So I'm home. I have an 8-pack. I believe I have an 8-pack of half-price hearts, everything's going fine, and my phone rings. And it's my mother with very sad news. She's called to tell me that our beloved great-aunt, Aunt Lucille, has died at 86. And Aunt Lucille was our family's favorite aunt, and it was very devastating, and I start crying, and my mother's like, I know, she was my favorite aunt, too. And we're crying, and we're on the phone, and it's very devastating. And I hang up, and obviously I go right for the egg. I mean, the heart, the Reese's heart, because I think this is going to make everything better. If I just eat my Reese's heart, I can eat away the pain, and I'm going to feel okay about my Aunt Lucille dying. And I go to find the Reese's heart, the 8-pack that I have, believe I have, and they're gone. And then the crying really starts. And now I'm weeping, and there's things being thrown, and I want to make a collage about my memories. Everything's sad. And I call my husband at work, who was at the time working at an investment bank. And I call him and I say, Dan, I'm so upset. Aunt Lucille has just passed away. And he goes, oh, Margo, I'm so sorry. I know she was your favorite aunt. We had so much fun with her at our wedding. I go, I know. I'm really, really upset. And did you eat all of my Reese's hearts? And he goes, what? I go, you heard me. Did you eat all of my Reese's hearts? And he goes, no. And I go, well, they're all gone. And he goes, well, there were 4 left, and I had 4. Which I guess somewhere in his brain means there were originally 8, so if he only ate 4, he didn't eat them all. So I flip. I really, you guys think I flip before, I flip on the phone. And I'm like, how dare you? You know, it's, you know, I mean, you know what? We are getting very close to Easter. Now it's going to be just full price, and then nothing. And my aunt is dead. And I'm like freaking out. And he goes, Margo, you can't call me at work. I work at an investment bank. You cannot call me at work over nonsense like this. I go, oh, nonsense, really? Death is nonsense? Death is nonsense? And he says, are you really calling me about death? And I say, no, no, actually, I'm not calling you about death. So we hang up, and I'm fuming, and I'm crying, and I'm fuming, and I go for a walk. And on the corner, there's a 24-hour Rite Aid. And I go, you know what, let me just check. Because God forbid we pay full price for those goddamn eggs at this at a time like this. I look, and the Rite Aid has 2 8-packs of half-price hearts left, and they're open 24 hours. So I feel like if he can somehow get home in time and get these for me, maybe our marriage will be saved. So I go, and I meet him at a party that night, and he gives me the biggest hug when he greets me, and he goes, are you okay? Are you okay? And I go, yeah, I'm all right. And he goes, I know how much you loved your Aunt Lucille. I go, there's a 24-hour Rite Aid on the corner. And everything I just said to you. So after the party, we go to the Rite Aid. We get not one, but 2 8-packs of the Reese's Holiday Hearts for the price of one, may I remind you. I'm elated. I love a bargain more than I love food. And I feel okay until the funeral a few days later. And I'm there, and it's very sad, and we're surrounded by all of these people that loved my Aunt Lucille so much, including me and my mother and my brother and my father and my husband, and her body goes into the ground. I cry, and my husband gives me this beautiful hug, and he goes, it's okay, sweetie, it's okay. And all I can think to myself, you know that moment, like when you're not supposed to think about something, you know, like in Ghostbusters with the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man? Like, I'm trying to be in the moment, and I'm crying, and I'm looking at her 5 children, and I'm trying, and all I can think in this horrible moment is, oh, thank God this happened in between the time, between heart and egg. Because if this happened in the period of darkness between egg and pumpkin, I have no idea how I would have handled this. Thank you.
If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. Good Food is also available on demand on KCRW's apps for the iPod, Android, and BlackBerry. And don't forget to download our special bonus podcast, The Piecast. There's lots of pie information in all those little piecasts. I want to thank everyone who called and joined KCRW during our semi-annual membership drive. From everyone at KCRW, a big thank you. Good Food's produced by Jillian Ferguson. Laurel Garcia and Candace Moyer are our segment producers. The executive producer is Harriet Ells. Thanks to Ronnie Mickelson, Gary Masiha, Becky Nelson, and Becky Gephardt. And a very special thank you to our friends at The Moth. It was a blast. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll see you back here next week for another edition of Good Food.